You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although lead poisoning has been recognized as a totally preventable threat to children's neurological health for decades, the Centers for Disease Control recently estimated that nearly 500,000 preschool-age children in the U.S. have elevated levels of lead in their blood today. Those children who are at increased risk for learning disabilities, behavioral problems, and permanent brain damage are largely from poor minority families who live in buildings where the walls and windowsills are still covered with chipping lead-based paint, although it was outlawed in 1978, 35 years ago. In their new book, Lead Wars: The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's Children, Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner look at how and why the public health effort to eliminate childhood lead poisoning seems to have stalled. It's published by the University of California Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings them back to our show today. Hello.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here.
Gerald, you've described childhood lead poisoning as one of the nation's oldest and most frustrating public health epidemics. Haven't we treated it with less urgency, at least in recent years, than we have treated other epidemics like polio, SARS, West Nile virus, et cetera?
We've absolutely treated it with less urgency, not just in the last few years, but throughout its history. And in part, that's because the lead industry has sought to deny how difficult the problem it's been and how many children it has affected. They've constantly said that the numbers are too large, whereas independent medical and public health people say the numbers are all too low.
Is it also because it primarily affects poor people?
I think absolutely. It affects poor children, either black or Latino or poor whites. And we as a society don't seem to value poor children's lives as much as we do rich children's lives.
Well, as we've seen with the sequestration and cutbacks on Head Start programs, which obviously are not as important as cutbacks on planes leaving on time. David, at one time, didn't the public health community see its campaign to halt childhood lead poisoning as one of its greatest victories?
Well, it's both a victory as well as a defeat. On the one hand, really in the beginning of the century, of the last century, lead poisoning used to send kids into convulsions, comas, and cause them to die. We have, in some sense, stemmed that epidemic of we don't generally see kids going into comas anymore.
And why is that?
Well, we did a number of things. First, the public health community managed to get lead out of gasoline, which is, for all of us over a certain age, we can remember when lead was a common gasoline was all leaded gasoline.
Well, it took the ping out of the...
It took the ping out of the motor, yeah. And so... it was a 60-year fight from the first time that it was discovered that lead was a neurotoxin and was a danger in gasoline to finally get it out. And finally, in 1995, it was finally banned. And also, we managed by 1978 to get lead out of paint, which was the major, major source for the lead industry at that
point.
But
it's still there.
Well, the problem is that we let the genie out of the bottle, despite the fact that literally the entire nation was covered by lead, and we had known about the dangers of lead for close to a century and its impact on children. We had basically polluted our entire environment, and we ended up, you know, creating a terrible public health hazard every time we nail a nail on the wall or we renovate a kitchen or, you know, not just African-American or Hispanic kids, but any suburban homeowner who moved into a house that was built before 1978.
Is this similar to asbestos, where it's just too expensive in some cases to get rid of the stuff?
Well, it's a question of our priorities. You know, no one would suggest that, you know, rich children live in an environment with a known toxin without getting rid of it. But with poor children, we're quite willing to let them live in an environment that is infested with lead.
And later we'll talk about a study which actually worked with that, kind of a shocking study. Hasn't it been suggested that the children who have this exposure to lead are also more likely to commit violent crimes when they reach adolescence. Is that a result of neurological damage?
Well, there is very interesting research that has been done that suggests that because lead interferes with neurological development, it causes behavioral problems, loss of impulse control, attention deficit disorder, and that those children end up more likely to commit crimes.
David, didn't the government only start to take action on the problem of lead poisoning after the Black Panthers and the Young Lords made lead poisoning a symbol of racial and class oppression in the 1960s?
Exactly. When you look at the history of this sad, sad epidemic, we've known about the neurological impact of lead since really the 1920s when these kids were going into convulsions. But it really took the social movements of the 1960s to make lead and lead poisoning kind of a symbol of the inequalities of the society. Before that point, we all assumed that this was just a medical or a public health problem. And what the Young Lords did and the Black Panthers did was make it a prime symbol of the exploitation of poor communities, of bad housing, of slum dwellings. And then we started seeing action taken.
Well, for decades, manufacturers claimed that lead was an essential ingredient of paint and of gasoline. Of course, we now know that both can be made without it. What purpose did the lead serve in paint first?
Well, any pigment that is put in paint, and there is zinc-based pigments, there's now mostly titanium-based pigments.
Are they any healthier?
Much healthier. Children are not dying or becoming brain-impaired as a result of ingesting titanium or zinc-based paints, only with lead.
So are zinc and titanium more expensive? Is that why industry fought so hard to retain the lead?
No, I think that there was really a very big self-interest on the part of the industry. The people who produced the pigments that went into the can of paint, I should explain that, when you think of a can of paint, we often think of just a lot of liquid and a little bit of color that you smear on the wall. When you go into your grandfather's garage and you pick up a can of old leaded paint, you feel how heavy it is. And that's because half that can will be made out of lead chromate, literally. And when you try to mix it and stick a stick in it, you realize that you come up against this block of heavy metal at the bottom. That's lead. That's the poison that's going to hurt us. So that we literally took all of our walls and covered it with this material. So it wasn't a question of happenstance. It was a question of the interest of an industry in selling their lead, because the pigment manufacturers were literally the people who were mining the lead. They had an interest in selling the lead from their mines.
So there was synergy in that industry, but not in the petroleum industry. Why were they adding lead?
Well, again, from the 1920s, in the 1920s, the major car that dominated American society was the Model T Ford. If you remember, it went at a strong 35 miles to 40 miles an hour at its height and was great for local traffic. General Motors at that point and DuPont and the Standard Oil Company at that moment discovered that if you add lead, what's called tetraethyl lead, to gasoline, it improves the performance of the engine, and you can build bigger and heavier and more attractive cars. So that's when we had the Cadillac developed and the Buicks and all the big, heavy cars, the muscle cars, so to speak, that would dominate it.
But we still have big muscle cars today, and they're not using lead in the gasoline.
Right. It was not impossible.
Did people not know at that time what they might substitute?
Well, there was a real, battle going on. This was a method for one part of the industry to really create dominance, and no one looked for these other substitutes.
Now, Gerald, you've said that despite the known risks, the world's lead mines are producing more lead than ever before.
Well,
first of all, where is it being mined?
Well, it's being mined in Peru. It's being mined in Russia. It's being mined, all over the world.
And what is it being used for today?
Well, unfortunately, all of us have our personal devices, our cell phones, our iPads, our computers, and all of those use lead. And certainly lead is used in most widely in batteries, so that it's ironic that our Priuses, our hybrid cars, which depend upon batteries, are actually increasing the use of lead.
And so the big problem now is not that we're exposed to it, but that when the battery goes dead and so we have to dispose of it, we wind up poisoning the environment?
Well, that's the issue, that unlike paint and unlike gasoline, which were out there in the environment already, the new products are often self-contained. And if we figure out good methods for actually disposing of these materials and controlling the, and recycling them, it's not as dangerous to us immediately. The problem is that we throw out our computers and we throw out our screens and they get into dumps and then we have this lead back in the environment.
My guests are David Rosner and Gerald Markowitz. Their book, Lead Wars, The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's Children. Gerald, one reviewer referred to the two of you as public health historians. Is that how you see yourselves?
Well, certainly we are both historians of public health, but we also feel like that we are public health advocates, that we are people who are concerned about the fate of our children, the fate of our grandchildren, and that public health needs to take a more active role in protecting all of us.
Well, you were guests on this show 5 years after the 9/11 attacks to discuss the state of our country's public health infrastructure. Has that situation improved or worsened since then?
Well, I think that there has been both improvement in some ways in development of infrastructure, but there has been less of a priority for public health to deal with the variety of environmental toxins that we're concerned with. I mean, things like mercury and arsenic and flame retardants in furniture. And public health works at the margins of those areas. They have not been able to really work towards the prevention of illness.
The government has lowered the levels of arsenic that, or allowed for more arsenic in our drinking water, for example. But is that doing anything to destroy our health?
Well, arsenic is a carcinogen, and flame retardants that are in all of our furniture.
No wonder I'm not feeling so well these days. But drinking a lot of water.
Well, it is interesting that the government is now, the CDC is now doing biomonitoring of the population. They're actually following 221 chemicals that 25 or 40 years ago were not in our bodies but are now in our bodies, and they're actually doing a sample of the population to see what the long-term effects of our exposures are.
So that's a hopeful sign, isn't it?
I think it's probably a very depressing sign from my point of view. They don't really we're allowing many, many toxins into the environment, and we don't really know what they do to us. And so the question is, should we be preventing illness, which would mean really proving to ourselves that this is not a dangerous substance before we introduce it? Or do we have to wait 10, 20, 30 years to see the endocrine disruptions, the biological effects of these low-level toxins that are being introduced?
In essence, we are engaging in a grand experiment to see which of those toxins are going to kill us or make us ill 20 or 30 or 40 years down the line.
My guests are Gerald Markowitz, who is Distinguished Professor of History at John Jay College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and David Rosner is the Ronald Lauterstein Professor of Public Health and Professor of History at Columbia University, co-director of the Center for the History and Ethics of Public Health at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. They have collaborated on another book. We'll talk in a few minutes about the first book and get into some of the shocking studies that have been conducted along the way. Their new book is called Lead Wars, The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's Children. It's published by the University of California Press. Stay with us for more. We are back with Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner, who have collaborated on a book called Lead Wars, The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's Children, published by the University of California, Milbank Books on Health and the Public. It's a series. Was the first book that you published, the one that brought you here on lead poisoning, was that also by this publisher?
Yes. The University of California and Milbank have a series, and our first book that we were here for, To See Denial, was also published in that series.
And that came out of your being hired in 1996 by New York City's law department to evaluate a stack of documents about the lead industry because of a pending lawsuit.
Right.
Were you surprised by what you found when you first began to study those documents?
Well, it was an extraordinary opportunity because here we were presented with all these secret, private documents of the lead industry that historians and the general public never get to see.
The same sort of thing that was found when people looked at the documents of the tobacco industry, that they knew the dangers of their product?
Absolutely. They were talking about children dying as early as 1930. And they were saying that this is a public relations problem, not a public health problem.
So they did things like create the Little Dutch Boy to make lead paint seem benign?
Well, the Dutch Boy had actually been created in 1908, but it became a very important symbol for marketing the safety of their, quote, safety of their product to counteract the increasing number of articles that were appearing in the professional press about the dangers of lead and kids who were being poisoned.
Well, was it criminal for them to encourage people to use it to paint nurseries and cribs?
Well, it wasn't, unfortunately, criminal.
I mean, that's what the courts decided?
Well, the courts had never decided that, and it still is a question, really up until 1978, whether it was ever a criminal act. The problem was that the industry had enormous power, and American companies are generally dependent upon. We depend on American companies to act morally. We don't generally try to regulate them, and we have an anti-regulatory stance here.
Well, what happened when doctors and researchers said lead was injurious? How did the lead industry deal with that?
They published an ad in National Geographic that said lead helps to guard your health. They would put out these little booklets for children saying that the Dutch Boy was your friend and you should paint your playroom with lead. They were, you know, reassuring the public that lead was safe at a time when they knew it was killing children.
That's like those ads for Camel cigarettes that said there was this T-zone and more doctors. Did they say more doctors smoke Camels or Luckies or whatever than any other cigarette?
Absolutely. I think Joe Camel was modeled on the Dutch Boy in my cynical view of the world.
Well, David, you mentioned the anti-regulatory attitude in America. That hasn't always been the case. Is it something that has happened, I guess, since the Reagan administration?
Well, since
Maybe
the Reagan
Carter.
Administration, it's been emphasized, but there's always been this strand of American culture and American history that worries about the intrusions of the state in our private lives. And that's always played upon by industries that are poisoning us. And they play upon that sense that we should have to keep government out of our lives. And for most of American history, there were no regulatory agencies. There's no EPA, OSHA, NIOSH to really control any of these companies.
So lead was outlawed in 1978, and then we just forgot about it after that?
Well, researchers certainly didn't forget about it. Public health people certainly didn't forget about it. They knew that children were continuing to be severely damaged, their life chances being altered and destroyed. And there was lots of advocacy to do something about it.
Well, 95% of American children now have blood levels below the CDC's acceptable threshold. So we're talking about 5% of America's children, which doesn't seem like a lot, but that's what, half a million kids?
That is more than half a million children are have too much lead in their blood.
If there were 3 children in the country that had a low-level meningitis, we would have a national mobilization to deal with this issue. But here's a half million kids, and we somehow feel like that's acceptable. In any public health sense, it's a massive epidemic.
And hasn't the CDC lowered the blood levels that it judges to be acceptable? It's done that several times over the past 50 years.
Yes, and that's been part of an enormous struggle over the last, really, half century. In the 1960s, it was acceptable to have, you know, 40 to 60 micrograms per deciliter blood of lead. By the 1980s, it had gone down to 25. And at every step, the industry claimed that the research that these new lower levels was based upon was inadequate and not right.
And now there some scientists believe that any amount of lead in the system is bad.
Right. Throughout the 80s and 90s, it became apparent that even 10 and 5 micrograms was much too much. And we're at a point now where we don't even use the word safe when we talk about these levels. We talk about acceptable, or we talk about elevated. We don't even use the word safe because we don't know what level is safe.
Well, Gerald, with that in mind, why has the CDC recently abandoned its blood screening programs?
Well, this is a direct result of the attacks on government that the Republicans have been doing.
But there's a Democrat in the White House, isn't there?
Well, unfortunately, the Democrat isn't the one who appropriates the money for the CDC. And it's really been an outrageous effect because in a variety of cities, it's just reported in Detroit, where children are no longer being tested and programs are being eliminated to help children who have elevated blood lead levels.
Can you tell us about the various studies, including the one at Johns Hopkins, that began to look into these kinds of things? Is that when they started opening up schools of public health, when we started discussing these issues?
Well, no. The schools of public health go back into the early part of the century when we were thinking about how are we going to deal with the big health problems of the country. How are we going to get pure water into every home? And public health was this expansive field which really thought about, you know, getting sewage systems in and bringing water from hundreds of miles away. And what's sad about what happened at Hopkins by the end of the 1980s and early 1990s was that we had had a real attack on public health, and we no longer felt we could really do these massive infrastructural changes.
Is that partly because the scientists wanted to keep out of politics? They just thought that this was a totally scientific area when, in fact, it's a political and economy-driven issue as well?
Well, I think that the public health profession has basically abandoned the idea of prevention because they've accepted the political constraints of this conservative anti-regulatory era. And that, you know, not all public health people have done that, but too many of them have, and the result is that children are being harmed.
My guests are Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner. Their book, Lead Wars, The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's Children, published by the University of California Press in their Milbank Books on Health and the Public imprint. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A number of listeners have written in to ask you questions. I'll ask them now, and then I'll get back to Johns Hopkins, which conducted one of the most shocking studies I've never heard of until now, unfortunately. Sam on the Upper West Side called in to say that the city's Department of Water told him that all the city's pipes are lead. Is that true?
No. In some towns, that's true. In New York, by chance and by luck, we have mostly copper pipes. We have some lead jointings, but it's not as big a problem in New York City as it is, let's say, in Washington, D.C.
The jointings were lead was in solder?
Right, in the solder.
Solder no longer using lead?
Well, it's not so much that it's no longer using lead, but ironically, because of the power of the New York City unions, lead was not used when we put in our pipes, mostly, by and large, at least in large numbers of them, because it was too easy to use. So copper was used instead, which required skilled craftsmen to put it in. So ironically, it wasn't done for a health reason. It was done because of this strange history of New York's unions.
See, the unions aren't all bad, are they?
Not at all.
Bruce from Manhattan asks, can lead in parking lots that have been there for 10 years be dangerous to school children? For example, if they're dug up, as we've seen on the Upper West Side.
One of the major sources of lead right now is still the remnants of the lead that has ended up in the soil and on the floors and in our atmosphere, going back to when lead was used in gasoline.
So you can't plant vegetables in New York soil.
it's a worry. It's a concern because these are basically toxic waste dumps. Any open lot in a, you know, next to a building usually is a building that used to be there.
Will that ever clean up if we just plant a lot of flowers? Will they eat up the lead and clean up the soil?
Unfortunately, no. Lead is there forever, and unless you remove the soil and get rid of it, you're not going to get rid of the lead.
You have focused in your book on a controversial federally funded study conducted in Baltimore during the 1990s by the Kennedy Krieger Institute at Johns Hopkins University. What was the purpose of that study?
Well, the purpose of the study was try to find a cheap way of lowering children's exposures to lead. How can we find a way of getting a lot of lead off the wall? And how can we do it in a way that landlords will have it done, will actually be willing to pay for it? So what Johns Hopkins did, and somewhat unfortunately, very unfortunately, is they set up a series of houses and recruited parents with young children to live in these houses. And these houses were divided into three groups that had minimal, more significant, and major renovations. In other words, they had removed some from a little to a lot of lead. And then they moved families, young women, by and large African-American young women, with children between ages of 6 months and 6 years, into these homes and took the blood lead levels of children over the course of a number of years to see which house was least damaging.
Now, this is, Gerald, this is after the famous Tuskegee syphilis tests on black men between 1930 and 1970. They must have been aware of the fact that what they were doing would sound all too similar.
Well, unfortunately, they didn't. They thought they were doing something that was going to help the children. And they were compromised by the fact that they accepted the fact that we cannot get rid of lead from children's environments if they're in poor people's homes.
And they were unwilling to recognize that we really had to invest in doing this.
And those researchers, the ones who conducted the study, J. Julian Chisholm and Mark Farfel, were sued for endangering the health of their subjects. How did the courts rule?
Well, unfortunately, they were not personally sued. Johns Hopkins was sued.
Now there is a court case against – isn't there a suit against them, pending against them? For knowingly placing children in homes that contain lead?
Yes, this is a current suit. But the response of Johns Hopkins was, we were just doing good in the community. And if you look at the informed consent forms that they gave to the parents to sign on behalf of their children, you see that these parents were never warned that their children could be lead poisoned. And that is one of the more shocking parts of this, is that they were observing children in their environments and not warning the parents that their children could be permanently damaged.
Was the study stopped at a certain point when people realized that was a big mistake?
Well, the study went on for a number of years, I think, until 1997. Is that right?
That recently.
Yes. And then there was a lawsuit that was brought, and in 2000, this was a lawsuit that resulted in the appeals court in Maryland, basically stating that this was very much like Tuskegee. In fact, they stated that they equated the actions at Johns Hopkins with Nazi wartime experiments on human beings.
Well, are Chisholm and Farfel still working in the public health field?
Chisholm is passed away, unfortunately. Something should be explained, that these – If they were just Nazis, it would be...
You seem to be expressing a certain amount of sympathy for them, even though somebody like, well, most people would find this rather shocking.
Well, it is shocking. It is shocking, but it's really as much a product of how public health has failed as a product of how they failed. And that's what we have to remember.
Well, Joe, critics compare the children in that Baltimore study to canaries in the coal mine, but you argue in this book that we're all canaries in a coal mine. Is it your contention that all Americans have become unwitting test subjects for untested toxic chemicals and compounds, not just lead, some of the others that you mentioned earlier?
Absolutely. I mean, with lead, the children being used were poor children, and that's been a horrible thing that has happened. But we're all exposed to the variety of chemicals that we talked about earlier, bisphenol A and phthalates and mercury and
took mercury out of vaccine. Well, they didn't completely. Actually, every flu vaccine has thimerosal in it, and that's mercury, isn't it?
Yes.
Right, but also from power plants, the burning of coal, mercury is spread in that way, so that we are all subjects in this research experiment.
And as you mentioned earlier, the CDC has begun monitoring American adults for 151 dangerous chemicals. What's going to happen when we find out that we have been killing ourselves?
We'll be in the same situation we are in with lead right now. We'll all throw up our hands and say, well, you know, we have sacrificed a generation, and we're going to be faced, and this is what the real point of the book is, we're going to be faced by this terrible choice of whether or not we're going to really try to get the genie back in the bottle, get the lead in, get the phthalates, get the mercury, get all these things that we're spreading freely into the environment out of our environment, or are we going to live with the after effects of it?
It is interesting that there's that cliche, get the lead out.
Yes. Right.
It doesn't mean this, unfortunately. My great thanks to both of you for being on our show. Gerald Markowitz is Distinguished Professor of History at John Jay College and Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He is, along with David Rosner, our other guest, co-author of Deceit and Denial, The Deadly Politics of Industrial Pollution. And David Rosner is Ronald Lauterstein Professor of Public Health and Professor of History at Columbia University and co-director of the Center for the History and Ethics of the Public Health at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Their book, Lead Wars, The Politics of Science and the Fate of America's School Children, is published by the University of California Press. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much.